Now, these are needs that grow out of the normal functioning of the personality. And for my own use, I have adapted an illustration that was originally designed by a non-Christian, a humanist, named Maslow. But I found this illustration has been very helpful as I look at a person and try to discern their needs. So I've taken this illustration and I've researched in the Gospels and the Epistles, and then I've used it for about 7 or 8 years, and I found that it's both theologically valid in most points. And I'll tell you the one point that we don't know. And then it's practically, I've found, very helpful. So I'm going to share that illustration with you. It's called Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. Now, Maslow says that our needs can be arranged like a stair step. And the point of the stair step is that needs which are lower level needs are more basic. That is, that if these needs are not met, they will demand with greater intensity to be satisfied than a higher level need. An illustration of this would be, let's say you were swimming underwater and you lost your breath. And all of your other needs, for example, the need to achieve in school or the need to do well in your job, disappears. The only thing you think of is getting enough air. See, that need is so basic that it dominates all others if it's deprived. Now, he has 5 levels, so let's go over each of the 5. The first level are physical. I pick a beautiful illustration of this up in Matthew 6, 31 through 34. If you have your Bibles, go ahead and turn there. We'll discuss that verse. In Matthew 6, the context is the kingdom of God, it's the Beatitudes. And all of us know 6:33, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these other things shall be added. Now, what were the other things that he was talking about? Well, back in verse 31, if I'm recalling it from memory, he's talking about, don't be anxious about what you shall wear, what you shall eat, or what you shall drink. That is your basic needs. Your food, your clothing, we might go ahead and extend it to shelter and that kind of thing. Everything that is basic. He says, don't be anxious about these things. And then he gives the rationale for not being anxious in verse 32. He says, for your Father, he says, the Gentiles, this whole, the rest of the world pursues these things. But you shouldn't be anxious because, that's the function of the for your Father knows you need these things. Now that's a very interesting statement. God knows we need these, and we aren't to be anxious because He is committed to helping us meet these needs. And it says a couple of things to me. The first is that God the Father has woven into our humanity certain basic human needs. And part of those are the physical needs. Those are not sinful. They are not part of the fall. They were part of the original equipment. Before Genesis 3. It is the way that we attempt to satisfy those needs that can become sinful. For example, anxiety about whether I'm going to eat. So, here we see the basic need, the physical needs. Now, go on to look in verse 34. There we have the second level. Maslow calls this security. Notice the word in verse 34, tomorrow. He says, therefore, in light of what I've told you about what God knows and what He promises to do, therefore, don't be concerned, don't be anxious about tomorrow. We meet our needs that we have today, But then the next thing we automatically think of is, ooh, do I have enough for tomorrow? Now, that is also a basic human need, the security for my survival tomorrow. And Maslow puts this right after physical needs. Note also, I think we can conclude from this verse that our Father knows we have needs for security tomorrow also and provides for that. Next is the need labeled love. Now this is a two-sided coin. It is the need to give and receive love. I see this most clearly probably in Matthew 22, verse 37 through 40 is the discussion where one of the men, one of the intellectuals in Christ's day asked Jesus, now what is the greatest commandment? And Jesus says, well, to love the Lord thy God, you know, with everything, and to love thy neighbor as thyself. Now, think with me a minute about the purpose of the law. What was the law? Well, one, the law was the revelation of the very character and personality of God. It reveals who God is, a righteous God. And in the summation of the law, in Matthew 22, Jesus partially is saying, the very character of God is love. And God has sown that quality, that aspect of His personality into our human personality. We also need to both give and receive love. Now, there's another point here. Why was the law given to us? Well, at one point, Jesus says the Pharisees were criticizing Him for eating grain on the Sabbath. And He wheels on them and He says, the man wasn't made for the law. Man wasn't put together in order to meet the law. The law was made for man. The law is given for man's best interest. If he keeps the law, he benefits. Because the law reveals his basic nature, the way he's made. And here in Matthew 22, Jesus is saying that woven into man's basic nature is this need both to give love, that's the commandment to love God and others, but also to be loved. We love others as we love ourselves. We must have a love for ourselves in order to love others. We have a need to feel loved. This really comes out clearly when you get involved with a person that's lonely. It just comes into sharp focus. One day in the dormitory at seminary, there was a phone call. And the person asked for Dave. And I was the only person on the dorm named Dave, you know, so I pick it up. And I didn't recognize the voice. And this guy starts telling me how he's thinking about committing suicide and would I come over and talk to him. And sure, but I didn't know him. So he gave me his address. And so I go over and it's kind of this seedy old apartment building, you know, and roaches crawling all over the place. And I knock on the door, you know, and nobody answers. I knock again, I can hear the radio, and nobody answers. So finally, the door kind of cracks open, and this little face looks out. And somehow, this guy had met a Dave from seminary who had talked to him. And he knew that he was from Dallas Seminary, and his name was Dave. And the guy was so lonely that he opened the phone book and found the number... And he called up and he asked for Dave. And he got me. And as I talked to this guy, the major problem was that he was desperately lonely. He was an orphan and he had moved to this big city with no friends and had lived there for 6 months. And he was just desperate. Well, it was really a living illustration to me that we have a tremendous need to love and be loved. The next level is the need for esteem. Now, this is the need to feel worthwhile or valued. And it's we get this sense of worth from a reference group. That is, a group of people to whom we look for approval and feedback that we're a worthwhile person. I was on the ski lifts in Breckenridge not long ago, and so I was riding up, and I was sitting next to a high school student. And, you know, and he was one of these, had one of these slick ski suits and super skis and everything. And I says, do you like to ski? And he says, man, I really do. I says, why do you like to ski? He says, well, anybody knows that. I come up here and practice alone so that when I come up here with my friends, I can be the best man on the slopes. And I thought, he has a need for esteem. And the way he gets his esteem is through his reference group, his high school friends. And his thing is skiing. When everybody thinks of this guy, they think, there's a good skier. And that meets a very basic need in that young man's life. A passage that it's almost comical, and yet it's very instructive, is Mark 10, 37. And I believe it's James and John, the sons of Zebedee, and their mother has whispered in their ear to make a request to Jesus. And so the disciples are walking down the road, and John and James sidle up to Jesus, and they say, Jesus, we'd like you to do something for us. And he says, well, what is it? And he says, well, when you're in your kingdom, on your throne, we'd like you to seat us at the right and the left hand. Now, boy, that, you know, you would expect Jesus to turn on them and say, you fools, you know, you're supposed to be humble and just rebuke them. But what does Jesus say? He says, well, that is not for me to give. And he stops. He does not rebuke them for that desire for greatness. Well, the other disciples hear about it, and they are, I forgot the word, they're not enraged. They're kind of, what does it say there? They're indignant, right. They're indignant because these guys had beat them to the punch. And so Jesus gets this vibe, you know, and he says, now, wait a minute. Now, when the Gentiles, their leaders, their rulers, they lord it over their subjects. But it's not to be that way among you. If you want to be great, you must be a servant. Now, what that passage says to me is this. Men have a need to be worthwhile. In this sense, the particular expression was greatness. But it's the same need. It's the need for significance, esteem, worth, or value. And Jesus does not rebuke them for the need. He rebukes them for the way they want to fulfill that need. But he says there is a godly way to become great, that is, gain a sense of esteem. And what that says to me is that Jesus himself recognizes this need. It is not sinful. It's not a part of the fall. The way we try to satisfy it is a result of the fall. The last level is labeled actualization. Now, this is the need to cause to become an actuality our ideals. The word is formed the same way that crystallize is formed. If you want to make crystals, you crystallize. And if you want to become, if you want an ideal to become an actuality, then you actualize it. And this particular characteristic says that once we form an ideal in our mind, that creates a need for us to actualize it. Most of us have probably experienced this when we do a study on what is a New Testament disciple. And we get about 10 or 15 characteristics, or maybe 5. And, you know, as the Word speaks to us, that creates a tension within us to become what we see there. We have a need to cause to actualize or make actual the ideals that God is feeding into our system. One illustration of this is in John 4, where, if you remember, that's the woman at Samaria. And Jesus has walked all morning. It's high noon. He's hot, he's tired, and he's hungry. And the disciples have gone into, you know, the little town there to get, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken or something. And so he talks to the woman, and they come back. And they say, Master, eat. And he says, I have food that you know not of. And, you know, so they, wait a minute, who fed him? And they couldn't come up with any answer. And he says, my food is to do the will of the Father. Now, Jesus was hungry, but he had a need that was more dominant than hunger at this point. And that was the need to actualize his ideal. And it was more than that. I mean, it was an actuality. His obedience was a continual actuality. But this need to be obedient to the Father was a dominant need in this case. We're a little different than him because we sin. So we're always in the process of ideal, you know, actualizing. Although he was the ideal, so it's a little bit different. Now let me draw three applications from this. The first application is this. Every person will have a dominant pattern of needs. And if you understand what that pattern is, it gives you some insight in how to help them. For example, take a man that is has a poor family background. And by poor, I mean his parents were not that loving. Maybe they weren't even concerned for him. And it left him with a deep need in his soul to be loved. And so you meet him, and let's say he's come to Christ, or you lead him to the Lord. And the question is how to help him. So you start off and you start telling him about, boy, you want to be a man of God or a woman of God. And you know, start doing these things. And nothing happens. Nothing clicks. Why? It could be because we're not approaching him from his standpoint of his need. He needs relationship. He needs love. So the way to approach a person like this is build a relationship with yourself, with other meaningful people, and in the context of that relationship, he will learn discipleship. And ultimately, as he sees that he can have a love relationship with the living God, he will become turned on to make that thing go, to spend, you know, much time getting to know Jesus Christ, because that fulfills a basic need. However, we can make a mistake. We can go in and build a relationship with a person, spend hours with them, doing things with them, and they don't even know what we're trying to do. It doesn't make sense. You know, why are we spending all this time playing handball? I want to be a disciple for Jesus Christ. A good example of this is a doctor, an optometrist in Dallas. And he has a tremendous motivation to witness. So he hears about this seminar in San Bernardino, California. You know, 2 weeks, learn how to witness. Ooh, boy, he signs up, he buys his plane ticket, he flies out there. And he sits through the programs. No one spends personal time with him. He comes back. He learns how to share the four spiritual laws. He shares Christ with about every third patient that sits in his office. He leads people to Christ by the scores, and he's tremendously satisfied. But nobody built a relationship with him. In fact, it doesn't even matter. Why? Because his need was different. His need was to actualize his ideal of being a witness for Jesus Christ. What I'm saying is this. A person's dominant need gives us some insight in how to motivate them. Let me just give you a suggestion at this point. For a person who has a need for actualization, what they need is a broad but somewhat vague outline of how to accomplish their ideal. The person who has a need for esteem, well, I'll get into that next. I won't say that now. The person with a need for love, for example, needs a context of relationships. But relationships with people who have, a working relationship with God. Okay, that's the first application. Determine the dominant pattern and use that to give you some insight into how to help this person. The second is this. When you look at a person, think in terms of their potential and not their problems. You see, as a person meets his need here, then he will move to the next level. And then as the person's need is met here, he will move to the next level. And this is one of the characteristics of maturity, a person who is secure in his sense of love, esteem, and is trying to attain his ideals. Now, a person who is handicapped emotionally may never move off of this thing, but he may get enough of a context so that he can move and work on these other ones. We'll look at a case history where this actually happened. It takes maybe from 7 to 10 years, but that's short in God's timetable, really. So, let me give you an illustration here. There was a man that was a terrible stutterer, and he had a tremendous complex. You know, he'd get up in speech class and you'd cringe. You know, he'd try to make a speech. You know, boy, by the time he was through, four or five sentences, and that was the speech. You look at him and you say, good grief. He has zero potential. Today, that man is one of the leading linguists for Wycliffe. He was one of the men that broke through it's the tonal barrier. That is, it's hearing the tones in these tonal languages. And it was one of the major linguistic problems that Wycliffe faced. You know, we look at the man and we say, good grief, problems. God looks at him as his potential. And it is so easy. I do it so many times. I look at a person and I say, boy, that guy's got so many problems. I didn't even want to spend time with him. Another example is a guy that, he's another story, this criminal, led me to Christ. I mean, an ex-convict. And so then I took my classmate to him, and he led him to Christ. And then the guy that led me to Christ moved away. So here I was with this classmate. And this classmate, good grief, he had this little cloud that followed him around and rained on him. And he was just, boy, depressed. And he was the kind of guy who was kind of fat, and he'd sit in front of TV and smoke all day and flunked out of classes. He couldn't hold a job. You know, I looked at him and I thought, good grief, problems. You know, he'll never be a disciple. Let's move on. Well, fortunately, God didn't let me move on. And that was 62. Today, not because of me, but, God was faithful to him. Today, the guy is heading up an evangelistic program in a local Baptist church. He's probably one of their leading deacons there. And he's leading a class in apologetics, and he's working in art. And I look at him today, and I think, good grief. I'm sure glad I'm his friend. It's kind of a privilege being a friend of the guy. You see, we have a tendency so frequently to look at a person in terms of his problems rather than from God's point of view, his potential. So one of the things this thing teaches me is to look at people from the standpoint of their potential and realize it's going to take time if he starts low down on the scale. But that's fine. God's got eternity. And God's committed to making that person a saint. The third application grows out of this area right here, esteem. This is probably one of the most helpful insights that I've gotten for me personally, and that is this, that at the center of our personality is the need for worth or esteem. And that's like a nerve quick. You know, when you go to the dentist and he hits the nerve in the tooth, you know, boy, you just go everywhere. And esteem and worth is the nerve quick of the personality. It is so sensitive, in fact, that we must defend it. And we will build all kind of walls around it. To make sure that our worth isn't destroyed. You know what will happen if a man's worth is destroyed? We get a good illustration of it in the communist brainwashing. If you read the case histories, for example, some of the missionaries in China who went through this brainwashing, one of the things they'd do is after a certain period of time of questioning and interrogation, they'd chain this man in a room. And they would surround him with four other men who were further in progress in brainwashing, who were making progress. And it was these four men to harass him day and night and tell him how worthless he was and how guilty he was. Day and night. The man couldn't move for weeks. And the point of progress came when the man became convinced that he was worthless. And at that point, he would usually have what we would say was a mental breakdown or an emotional breakdown. And they could get him to sign anything. That was the breaking point. If they could destroy a man's worth, sense of worth, then they had gotten him. It takes, when these guys would come back to the U.S., it would take them several years to recover from that kind of experience. And they were always sensitive to being asked questions. But the man's sense of worth, if you destroy it, you virtually can destroy the person. Well, I mean, I'm saying that to show you that it's a very sensitive, it's the quick of the personality. And so when an attack comes, we build a defense. However, we only have so much psychological energy to defend ourselves with. And it's the same energy that we do our creative growing with. Well, now imagine a minute. If I spend my time criticizing a person or making them feel defensive, I'm going to absorb all of his energy that he would normally use in growth for defending himself. There are probably two schools of thought in terms of training. One is that I hover around a man and wait for him to make a mistake. And when he makes a mistake, whap! You know, and boy, then I wait again, see? And I correct him on the basis of his mistakes to help him. But that has a detrimental effect. He spends all of his time defending himself. He doesn't have any time, really, to grow. And I would submit to you that there is a different philosophy of help. And that is, help a man from the standpoint of his strengths. So whenever I get around a person, I look for his one strength. I try to figure out, what does this guy enjoy doing? What can he do well? And if it's true that God has given every believer a gift, then there is something he can do well. So I look, and I look, and I look, and finally it'll come to the surface. And then if you have a, you know, if it works out, I mean, if the Lord uses you in this respect, you help that person develop that strength until he knows that he's good at it. In fact, you can ask him or her, you say, you're pretty good at X. And when they smile at you and say, yeah, that's right, isn't it? Then you know that you've won the first battle. That there is something that they feel good at. And you take that success and use it as a leverage to pry them into other areas that they were afraid to get into before. So success is the leverage to help a person move into new areas. And for example, you can say, this is one of the things I've heard Peterson use, and it clicked in my mind. He'll say, you know, you're pretty good at this area. Yeah. And, you know, if you'd work on this area, you would really be better at it. And the person goes away feeling, boy, that was a big help. Rather than, ugh, yeah, that's right. See, they go away feeling helped rather than criticized. So the application is this. Help a person from the standpoint of his strengths, and that will release more creative energy for growth. So those are the developmental needs. Pardon? Okay. Help a person from the standpoint of his strengths, and that will release more creative energy for growth. Now the second type of needs. These are needs caused by sin. As we look at Genesis 1 through 3, or 4 and 5, one of the things that we notice is that the natural byproduct of sin is pain and death. You know, Adam sinned. And what did he do? Well, he heard Jesus coming and he hid in the bushes. Guilt. See, a breach of the relationship. Well, then he got thrown out of the garden and he got put under the curse. His whole lifestyle became more difficult because of sin. Romans 3:23. Sin pays its salary. And the salary is death. And whenever we sin, even in small ways, there's a salary to it. That creates needs in us. That creates pain within us. And this whole area is a need. Now, dealing with this, the man that has done the classic job is Jay Adams. In his book, Competent to Counsel, if you haven't read it, for this area is a must. I'd like to give you one illustration of how this works. And I give it because it's probably a common experience that all of us have. And that is the problem of depression. How do we deal with depression and where does it come from? Well, there are many aspects of it. For example, I think a certain vitamin deficiency can cause depression. That's another cause. But I want to take the one that's closely related to sin. In our personality, we have an ideal. That is, that the level of performance we'd like to be at. But then, we also have a self-concept. This is the level at which we perceive that we are right now. And there's always a discrepancy between these two. Now this discrepancy, when it grows to a certain level or, disparity or distance, we will experience anxiety. That's the first sign of psychological pain. And it might be manifested in nail biting or nervous activity. Like I usually am moving all the time. It's because I have a certain level of anxiety that's always there. However, when this distance grows to a certain, there's kind of a threshold or a cutoff point, and we perceive that we're getting so far from our ideal that we experience depression. That's a sense of despair or lack of hope. Now, the secular psychologist, particularly Freud, his solution to this was quite simple. He says, well, what you want to do is lower your ideal. You know, it's really all right to kick your dog or kill your mother or something. Since there are no absolutes, lower your ideal and you will reduce your depression. And that's true. He experienced a degree of success. However, as Christians, we know that's not the solution. The biblical solution is to raise our level of behavior. To put it another way, to stop sinning. But also, we must make sure that our ideals are biblical. If we put on ourselves burdens that God does not put on us, that is equally as sinful as sin. For example, I always have a problem with correspondence. I hate to do correspondence. And boy, the higher the pile gets, the worse I get to feeling. Ugh. So what do I do? How do I deal with that depression? Well, you know, I pull out that first letter, and I pull out that dictaphone, and I press the button in the back, and I press the button in the front, and I start to move my mouth. You know, and then I pull out the second letter, and the third letter, and the fourth letter, and pretty soon my depression is gone, because the stack is gone. Well, the way that we deal with depression is by raising our level of performance and making sure that our ideals are biblical. That's just one example of how to deal with sin. Jay Adams, like I said, has the most extensive treatment of it, and it would be well worth your while to read that. The next level of needs are labeled sickness. Sure.
If your ideas aren't biblical, then I feel they should be dropped.
Her question is, if the ideals are not biblical, should they be dropped? And I'm not sure I'd want to use that word. I would say they should be adjusted to the biblical standards, whatever that is. Does that good answer? Okay. Sickness are needs which grow out of the malfunctioning of the body. You know, it's probably pretty obvious. I was in a home with three other men, and we all were a ministry team that went out and hit this one campus. And all of the men were competent. They were motivated. They were operating at a pretty high level on this stair step of needs. But one of the guys, over a period of months, began to drop off. You know, and he would, his Bible study began to get kind of superficial. And we worked together, and we'd get up in the morning, and he'd wait till a quarter till eight to get to work by eight. You know, and obviously he wasn't getting his quiet time in. And we'd go out on campus a couple of nights a week, and it was like pulling teeth. The guy, when I'd go with him, he wasn't any help at all. He'd say, well, you take it tonight, you know, and next time you take it tonight. And you wouldn't say anything. And the temptation is, boy, get with it. Well, we sent him to the doctor, and he had mononucleosis. He was fighting a level of infection within his system that was absorbing all of his energy, and he could not maintain the same level of performance that we had. Well, the thing that we did was we put him on a different standard. He slept till a quarter to eight. Some weeks he didn't even go out on campus with us. And his Bible studies was, you know, if he's just opening the Bible, reading it, he's doing great. And he'd get 8 and 10 hours of sleep a night because his needs were different. And so the standards for his behavior were different. And this is one of the things that we can be aware of for our peers. He would have never gone to the doctor. He himself felt... You know, oh, I'm such a sinner. You know, I've just got to get up earlier. And then the next morning he'd sleep till quarter to eight and he'd feel more guilty, see. And we had to tell him to go to the doctor. Why? Something in us that prevents us from saying, well, maybe I'm sick. And we can help our friends and our peers by giving them this kind of feedback. Well, look, maybe go get a checkup. Okay. Some people carry around low-level infections in their gums or just a level of infection that isn't even revealed in a temperature, but still their body is consuming a certain amount of energy fighting that thing. So this is something to be aware of and to help our friends with. The last type of need is labeled psychological. Now, all of these are psychological in a sense, especially the developmental needs are psychological. But I picked this term because I want to define it in this way. Psychological needs are needs which grow out of the malfunctioning or the mishandling of emotions. I met a friend on campus, and he was a music major, and he wore all black. In fact, he wore it so consistently, one night a car hit him because they couldn't see him crossing the street. And this guy would carry a normal course load of 15 hours, plus he'd practice 8 hours a day on one piece of music. And he did that all year. And the one piece of music was very unusual. It was by Prokofiev, who wrote Peter and the Wolf. But Prokofiev is a typical Russian author who also writes this real disharmonic music. And, you know, he'd say, hey, you want to listen to my piece? Ooh, okay. Ugh. You know, and he'd play it, and boy, just, ugh, you know, grind inside you. You know, it's like scratching your fingernails on a board or something. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Ugh, glad that's over. Well, one day we were riding along, and we passed a graveyard, and he shuddered. And it was so unusual. I said, well, what's the matter? And he said, well, you know, I saw my girlfriend killed in a car accident when she was 13, and I was 13. And I was standing there, and I was the first one there to the accident. And but I never shed a tear. This is my background is German, you know, and we just don't show our emotions. Now, that man was mishandling grief. All of us have a need to work out our feelings of grief. And this man had never done that. And it was affecting his whole personality. He had mishandled his feelings. To give you the follow-up on the story, he went to his grandmother's funeral and wept after several years of being a Christian. He became a Christian in the process and really had an outpouring of grief, and it was very unusual to see his personality begin to blossom. But that was a psychological problem. It wasn't sin. You know, it doesn't say that. And there's not in the Ten Commandments the commandment that thou shalt cry, but it's still basic. Another area where this is really beautifully illustrated is in the area of homosexuality. Now, the manifestation of homosexuality is sin. That's obvious from Romans. But the root dynamic, where does the root of forces or drives of this problem come from? They come from a person's sexual identity before the age of 6 in his relationship to his parents. In a sense, we might conclude that he has no volitional choice about his basic drives. Now, how he handles those, he does. And I'm not suggesting that that's a psychological problem. That's a sin problem. But the root cause, you know, the root formation of these drives is a psychological problem. It's a maladaptation of the personality. It's a malfunctioning of the personality. There's very little written on this area, and I'd like to recommend a series of tapes. They're by Dave Cotton, who's the pastor at Metropolitan Baptist in Oklahoma City. And he's done a recent study on this, or he's been counseling these type of people in his own church for a number of years, and finally decided that it was time to exposit the scriptural position. And so he's given 6 messages on this situation in his evening services. And I was looking for his address, just a minute. It's the Metropolitan Tape Ministry. I'll bring it to you next time. It's the Metropolitan Tape Ministry, and the tapes are Ethics, Homosexuality. I sent these to a friend of mine who's got the problem, and he says, boy, I listened to those, and I just wept. For the first time, I realized that, you know, it was a deeper problem than just sin. And the man is living in victory, you know, over the sin problem, but he's still plagued with the psychological problem, and he just never really felt like, well, he understood what was happening. He felt like God had deserted him. And But once he understood that it was a psychological problem, he says, oh, okay, I can live with that by the grace of God. Well, those are the psychological needs. I mean, that's an example of a psychological need. Let me stop here, and I'll wait till next week to get into the case histories. But I'd be glad to field any questions or observations that you might have.
Could you repeat the definition of psychological?
Right. That is the maladaptive or mishandling of emotions. It's not a good way to put it. Maladaptation or mishandling of emotions.
The majority of psychological needs be caused or based in, say, pre-adolescence, or is that just a certain case of homosexuality you talked about?
A lot of them come out of that. One example is this person who just always says, boy, I'm just worthless. I'm just, ugh, I can't do anything. And she's really a talented person. But she's so convinced that she can't do anything that she just kind of mopes around. Well, I found out about her family. And her family had a series of failures in it. No one in her family had been a success. You know, the high spot in their background was that her great uncle had been hung in the Civil War. You know, I mean, it was that kind of deal. And normally, you know, and I think she's been around 4 or 5 years, and she hasn't moved from that one situation. She's never gained a sense of worth, and people have really worked with her. And I would say, see, that comes out of her background. And it's a handicap, really. But then, like the situation with grief handles later in life. Or that's the only example I can think of now. So many of them do come out of earlier life.
You know, you say that understanding these is one of the big parts to helping them overcome some of these needs?
Partially, yes. There's also the thing that we need to be aware of is that we can't handle everyone's needs. For example, a person who has homosexuality, they may require someone that's more skillful or has different attitudes. Some of us just, you know, we just feel so uncomfortable with a person like that that we can't help them. But knowing that, yeah, this is the need, and that kind of need I really can't minister to, but so-and-so over here, they are really good at that kind of person. You know, then we know where to refer them. Does that help? Does that kind of answer what you're asking, or maybe I missed it?
That's part of it. I was just wondering, I get kind of the idea when you said psychological needs, and, that some of it's kind of like they'll never be met completely. It's not like the developmental needs seem like they're growing that. But
you're right. Some of these needs we can never meet. We can just adjust to. That's right. Bob?
Can the need for actualization, can that be a secular desire to achieve and that type of thing? Is that
right?
Area there?
Uh-huh. In fact, in Downing's studies, he says when a person gets up to this level of actualization, they'll go one of two ways. There's, 10% of the population that are achievers, and 90% of the population that are affiliates, or people that enjoy relationships. They gain their sense of fulfillment in relationships rather than in the arena of competition or achievement. And so that need does manifest itself in achievement.
You were going to point out one area where the theory did not...
Thank you. I forgot that. The area is the idea of hierarchy. That there is a hierarchy. I couldn't find that in Scripture. And I would say it's a human observation that seems to hold up in many cases, but I bet we could find exceptions to it. So, thanks.
Can you relate the two sets of needs here, these four categories, to the five steps?
Really, Betty, I think they're interrelated. Like, let's say my need for love, I can try to achieve that in a sinful way, and it goofs up the whole process. I never grew out of it. I may be fighting an infection, and I can't perform at the level I'd like to, so I never feel esteemed. So I would say that they are interrelated. Was that the nature of your question?
Yeah, and also how would you start to locate any by these four categories or the five steps?
Okay, let me give you a practical suggestion of normally what I do. I start off with the wheel. You know, I meet a person and I try to help them with the wheel. Start off with lordship and, you know, just work my way through it. But you can get into that thing and you can see it's just not coming together for the guy or the girl. It's just not fitting. And then you begin to ask yourself questions. Well, maybe there are other needs. Let me see if I can get a good example. Okay, this girl that I said had a very low sense of esteem. You know, she's a really quite disciplined in scripture memory and her quiet time. And she's not very good at witnessing. She doesn't relate to people very well. But on the wheel, she does really well. And yet you talk to her and, oh, you know, I'm just a failure. See, that tips you off. Ah, well, you know, it's not necessarily the spiritual needs that there are deeper needs there. So you begin to look. Or the person that is normally performs at a high level, like this guy that was sick. You know, he's performing at a high level, and then it's kind of unusual. He's not performing at that level. So you begin to ask questions. Ooh, maybe he's hung up on a psychological problem, or maybe he's sick, or maybe there's a sin in his life he's not dealing with. So I kind of start from the wheel, and then I work around this little circle here. Okay, let's call it quits for today then. We're dismissed.